Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with the Voice of Reason. I'm your host. Here's my guest, Paul Rossi. Paul Rossi is, was a math teacher at Grace Church High School, and he began to question the encroachment of critical race theory throughout that high school, stood up to it, and got some pretty strong backlash from the institution. He then recently, on April 13th, published an article on the Common Sense with Barry Weiss Substack, which kind of opened up that can of worms of bringing a lot of attention to bear on this high school. He was recently interviewed by Jordan Peterson, a Canadian psychologist, and that interview very thoroughly covers Paul Rossi's experience. If you want to learn more about Paul Rossi's experience, I recommend you go and watch that interview. If you've already seen that interview and want to know more about Paul Rossi, then this interview, I think, fits nicely together with Jordan's work. So without further ado, here is Paul Rossi, man of the month, I think. You've surpassed your 15 minutes. You went into an hour, and now...
Has it been that long?
Does it feel like you're kind of a cause célèbre?
I don't know. There's a lot of things popping in this space. There's Andrew Gutman. There's some other people are speaking up, and things are happening. Might be just part of a larger story. That's what it feels like.
I was thinking about your story, and it's covered very thoroughly in your Jordan Peterson interview. So maybe we could touch on it lightly.
Sounds good.
I highly recommend people check out that. Jordan does a very good job of pulling the details out of you in a very powerful manner. But I was thinking about the commonality between your story. So you were working for Grace High School, and then there was a kerfuffle around anti-racist training. You stood up. There was some tension there. And then did you lose employment?
I guess I would say I'm all but fired, which means my classes have been reassigned. My advisory is reassigned. So I have no more teaching duties. I haven't heard from the administration about my employment status at all. I did check my account, and I did get paid a few days ago. So I'm still getting paid.
Gotta like that.
I'm kind of thinking they're going to pay out the rest of my contract, which ends at August 31st. If they don't, I may be able to do something about that. We'll see. I'm just taking it week by week at this point. And doing a lot of volunteer work, in my time that I now I have available.
I came of age in a certain respect through a similar, but kind of different story involving Brett Weinstein. Brett Weinstein stood up against a certain diversity, equity, and inclusion push within the Evergreen State College. And then time elapsed, the students protested, and the students themselves were the forward guard at that movement. But with regards to what happened with you, it wasn't really the students. It was actually the institution or people in the institution. And it's kind of a familiar story now. It's just kind of something that happens. You either get on the die train or you get out of the canoe in a way.
Yeah, the canoe. I mean, I watched the Mike Nana's story of Evergreen, and I know that that's something that you went through with Brett Weinstein. And
Weinstein.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah.
So you've been aware of stuff going on outside of your particular high school, just in the college world at large then?
Yeah, definitely. And, it's interesting because a connection that I haven't seen anyone make with the Evergreen story is its connection to Cornell, which is my alma mater where I went to undergrad, and Cornell 1969, which I think was the early, was sort of the, there's so many parallels between Evergreen and what happened at Cornell in 1969 that, you know, this story is fascinating. I think you'd really enjoy looking into it because you had a group of radical students that took over the student union with bandoliers of ammunition and guns. And the entire campus, you know, was set to explode for like a couple nights with, you know, violence. There were the leader of this, of the students that took over the student union went on the air of the college radio station and threatened the lives of faculty to come to their homes. I mean, it was a pretty insane time.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, faculty were, you know, literally getting out of town, checking into motels because they were afraid of, you know, repercussions of going against the students. And my father was a law professor at the school at that time. And so he had firsthand stories about what it was like to be a teacher in that, you know, to be a professor in that environment. I think it was his second or third year teaching there.
Oh, really?
There. Yeah. There's a great book called Cornell 69, Liberalism and the Crisis of the American University. And, you know, I recommend it. It's an excellent and very balanced, I think, retelling of the events of that time and, you know, how, what the, you know, what were the events that led up to it? What were the immediate causes? What was the aftermath? And it's an interesting story. But yeah, it really reminded me of that.
When was that published, that particular book?
That was published, I'm looking at it now.
80s, 90s. Aughts.
It was fairly recent, I think. It was more recent
okay.
than that.
Okay.
It's so by I was going to say,
how long has
Donald
the American Pence. University system been in crisis? It seems like it's in perpetual crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. 2014, the book came out. So, and I think some of its source material, there were primary source materials, people who wrote a book about it as it was happening, which is now an archive, I think, in the Cornell Library that it's hard to get access to that, but they were able to get it and write a book using that
yeah.
material.
I hope all my work ends up in the Evergreen archives if they last. They're having some pretty terrible times right now.
Yeah, yeah. I hear are the enrollment and endowment, yeah. everything's affected. Yeah.
Yeah, they're finally getting rid of their president and they can't find a new one. They had three finalists drop out.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah,
not, you think it would be a plum job. Like people would be at least to get there, to stay there a little while.
It's a mess.
Wow.
It's a mess. There's so many layers of dysfunction at the place. It's phenomenal. And I've been reporting on it for 4 years now. I'm nowhere at the end and they keep on providing me with new dysfunction. So it's kind of this weird niche story that I've kind of found myself in, but it relates again, it relates to what's happening abroad. And I do, have you been thinking about the current climate and the climate of the 60s? A lot of social justice activism was happening then. A lot of militancy was happening back then, a lot of young people trying to change the world and really on fire for that. And it just seems like now the institutions have kind of absorbed the revolutionary rhetoric and are just able to co-opt any sort of revolt and just completely appease the students and go through this whole process of vilifying the scapegoat.
And yeah, yeah, no, and then there's generational, right? So waves. So you have the children of the revolution now, and yeah. then that's working its way through the larger society and you know, metastasizing in all the institutions and that template for accommodationist thinking and co-optation, but also, institutional moral bankruptcy, I think, has a lot to do with it. That since the civil rights movement, the hypocrisy of that, exposing, you know, the, you know, the moral authority of liberalism, you know, oh my gosh, that thing that we all want back now, it has to be reconstructed in some way. better, more like in a better way than just polishing the statues of John Stuart Mill or any of, you know, Locke or whoever. Like it has to be re-articulated in an art, in a, with art and culture in a regenerative way. You can't just sort of say, oh, I wish we could, we should go back to the, you know, it's got to be, it's, there's got to be a new idiom. There's got to be a new, it has to be done through art and culture, but I don't, you know.
So you're saying that the heterodox classical liberal thing is falling flat?
As no, I don't think it's falling flat. I think it's just one piece of what's, of it's the, you know, just like a, you know how like a bad, a neighborhood in a city, the artists come in first to sort of to reconstitute and set up shop there and sort of rebuild the neighborhood.
We're doing gentrifiers.
Yeah, the soft. So that's happening now in the intellectual level, but without a cultural accompanying cultural thing, it's not going to be, it's not going to have the power to affect. I think it needs to have that artistic blood coursing through its veins as well, you know, and you're starting to see that a little bit here and there, but you need a movement, like a cultural movement that's to complete the picture, I think. And, you know, that then you can start to do things like have media organizations and distribution, like Hollywood, right? Like they'll come to you. If you build it, I think they'll come.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think there's hope in, you were teaching high school, or you are teaching high school, or you're in the weird gray zone of being a teacher, not teacher of high school. What generation is that? Is that Gen Z, Gen Z kind of?
Yeah.
They're this generation, there's all the height commentary and twingy on the, you know, social media stuff and that. This stuff, but the ideology of intersectional critical social justice, yada, yada, wokeness, is now being forced on them at every level constantly. And then all their teachers are having to say it. Do you think that they are developing antibodies? Do you think that it's having the intended effect of creating good little anti-racists, quote-unquote anti-racists and stuff? Or do you think that there's a spark of rebellion already in the works there?
I think it's both. From what I, you know, what I hear, there's a lot of preference falsification going on.
What do you mean?
Students have said they're learning, you know, obviously my data is, the sample is, you know, that I'm getting. I have students that have approached me, and what they're saying is, I really asked them to try to be as empirical as possible given the situation, but they're saying, like, you know, over 50%, maybe a little bit more of the boys are falsifying their allegiance to wokeness or intersectional thinking. And then, you know, there's a gender gap. So a lot more of the girls are going along with it and true believers. So what that's hopeful, but also, you know, disturbing, because you've got a generation of kids. A lot of them are just learning how to lie and how to hide and how to get through. And that has a corrosive effect on their spirit, if, you know. I think that it's, you know, there are some, there's a handful of standout kids that are open about their doubts about this orthodoxy, this new orthodoxy, but they're very few and far between.
And the punishment is very severe. And so is the threat of punishment. If you're watching your authority figures getting taken out for simply questioning it, challenging it.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that is not the biggest fear. The greatest fear is probably the social opprobrium that would result from, you know, people thinking you're a racist if you don't buy into the idea of toxic whiteness being everywhere, or, you know, the, whatever the extreme exponent of this thinking is currently. I think there's a lot of fear about social exclusion and losing friends, like for adults, but yeah, and also, you know, from teachers, there's a fear that the school can sabotage your application. There are just so many things that you have to worry about as a student. You could get, you know, you don't want teachers, you don't want to get on the bad side of your teachers, mm-hmm. for one thing. So there's a lot of pressure. And I feel for students in that situation for sure.
And you said you're doing a lot of volunteer work, and I guess this is you're working with FAIR Foundation of
the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism.
Racism. In meditating on that and delving into that, and then also publishing that piece on Barry Weiss's Substack, and then receiving a lot of input. Where do you think you want to put your energies? Where do you think that if you want to go forward and continue to fight this or to try to correct the culture in some way against intolerance and racism, where do you think is what kind of age group or cohort do you think you want to focus on? And then what do you think is the best thing to do for, you know, whatever age group that you want to focus on?
Well, I'd like to, one of the projects I really want to work on is a student guide written by students for students, and to, you know, help edit that and help work with students who are currently in high school so that they can give advice to their peers on, you know, if you want to doubt this or challenge this orthodoxy, this CRT-based DEI and anti-racism, how can you do it in a way that, how can you be brave? How can you be smart? How can you approach this place where you can express your conscience without, you know, losing your mind and blurting out stuff and raging against the machine in a way that would be counterproductive to your, you know, to you. I think that students could really benefit from the advice of students who I have been in touch with that have been able to stand up and haven't, and been able to maintain their social status doing it. So they're popular kids. They're from all different backgrounds. So, you know, BIPOC, Latin, Latinx, white, whatever. There's a group of students I'm in touch with, and to have them work together on this guide and talk about how they accomplished that really remarkable feat, I think would be helpful.
What are some of the themes that you see in that? And is it replicable? Is it like a personality trait, or is it?
It may, you know, I think that has a lot principles. To do with it. We're talking about both. I mean, you're talking about a way of being in the world. Yeah. It's an ontological question. How do I be in the world when the world is requiring me to believe and profess certain things that I don't? Or conceal certain things that I don't want to conceal. How do I exist? It's an existential question, really. Like, and to the extent that these students, who I think are very knowledgeable and you know, intuitive about it, how can they articulate that those strategies for students that find themselves really at the loss and hiding under a bushel basket because they fear the consequences and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing.
In the communist regimes, at least in Eastern European communist regimes, I've read some into that. And like a lot of people were crushed. You said it's soul crushing to be under that, where you can't really think and you're always watching out and you're always watching what other people are saying. And you could be ratting on them or they could be ratting on you. And there's this huge stack of the antithesis of freedom of thought. And I even think freedom of joy, but also there's this adaptation that happens with language and with art where things start becoming dual meaninged. Like there's a way of that people start speaking where there's a meaning that they're hiding, bundling in to get through the censors and stuff. And mm-hmm. I don't want to romanticize that at all, but that might be a boon in a certain respect for certain people, but I don't know. What do you think? Like in aggregate, it's a terrible thing to live in a repressive culture, something that's completely alien to me growing up as a Gen Xer, like where we were required to push the envelope in
every
way.
Yeah, me too. I'm so grateful I grew up when I did, God. You know, I think that that's definitely part of it. That is a strategy that's available, subcommunicating on one level while you're saying one thing publicly you know, but it's very hard to do that because the critical lens, everyone's so attuned to the thing that was going to out you as being not, you know, problematic or whatever. So, you know, if you have, and some of these meetings with students, you'll have a student that says, well, I am anti-racist and I'm doing the work, but I think it's important to have, you know, a diversity of views. Well, that person's already, like, they've outed themselves. So you can't really, it's very hard to sub-communicate when the entire critical theory is about scrutiny, right? So the entire theory is tuned to, like, you got to notice just the thing that makes you different than the theory and then pounce. And, you know. It's hard.
That's exactly what happened to Brett Weinstein. I've told this story before, but when the protests were going on, I was on campus and a co-student of mine came up to me with a pile of his emails and said, these are Brett's emails. I know he's a racist, but I cannot find them. It's coded. He's really good at hiding his racism, you know?
Yeah.
So when you're up against that, what can you possibly do?
Yeah. It's a... Yeah, no, it's teaching people to be suspicious, resentful, paranoid, and really go over your stuff with a fine-tooth comb to find just the symptom.
Are you able to see through that lens and then put it back on the critical lens?
Oh, yeah. No, I can't stop seeing through that
lens. It's infected you?
Yeah, it's in there. It's in there. And whenever I have a thought, immediately I feel the other thought that's like, what would a person who has that mindset, what would they say about what I'm saying? Do you do that too? Where you just can't help it?
I can't really enjoy media. I have to analyze it through an intersectional lens all the time. And then I have
Right. How do you like it, white man? You know, how do you like it, cis, white, het, man? Whatever, like that thing. That thing is like part of my brain now.
Wait, you know, and when did that start? When were you first aware of that?
Long time ago, like this happened in
the Inquisitor,
the Inquisitor.
In the 80s.
Because you know, already I grew up in a very progressive town. Ithaca, New York, is a very progressive town because of academics and very left liberal place. Mm. And so, when you know, feminism was, even though I was still Gen X and there was punk rock and stuff, like those ideas started to percolate through our culture. Yeah, a lot earlier than some places.
PC thing in the 90s.
Yeah. And so I went to a large public high school. They're all different cliques, sort of like Breakfast Club, you know, but the faculty brat cohort that I was in were very progressive. And, you know, so I definitely felt... You know, and it's funny, there was already a place in my brain, so, because from Catholic school, you get a lot of Catholic guilt and so on. And so you could just plug in, you know, a woke guilt in your brain, and it kind of fits in that same slot. And it's just running a different program, but it's got like all the same hooks. The APIs are the same almost.
Yeah. Well, D'Angelo's thoroughly Catholic.
Oh, really? Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
She says, "Oh, this isn't Catholic guilt." It's like it's totally Catholic guilt. The whole thing. It's just like you just retooled it.
Makes sense. Okay. Yeah.
How did you adapt to that yourself? If you can put yourself back into running that program at an early age, like what parameters did that put on your, personality and your creativity and your ambition?
It was a real squelcher. I mean, it was a real envelope, like in an audio sense, like it really flattened the frequencies and kind of compressed me and made me, I had a lot of energy and spirit that was bottled up and trying, and I resisted it, and it created a lot of anger. You know, it was like incel kind of thing happening underneath the public professions of, you know, alignment with these left liberal ideas. And so I think that really wasn't healthy. That kind of crimped my style in a lot of contexts, because I was trying to be like a good male, you know, like a male, a sensitive male,
the ally,
a thoughtful feminist. The ally, exactly, the Yeah, but that really, you know, the funny thing is, like, when you're growing up, you realize later that, okay, that's not actually a bad thing if you know who you are. It can be okay. But if you don't really have a strong identity, like I didn't really have a strong identity even into my 20s and so on, like, it can be difficult because you're hiding. I'm hiding who I am in a lot of ways and kind of overlaying these mental superego programs that are trying to please people and trying to find out, you know, if they can tell me who I am, and running around, and it's kind of a mess.
So by identity, you mean like an ego self or a locus of agency, of a strong sense of self then.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And just to compare and contrast that to the intersectional identity packet, which would make you a white, cis, heterosexual, et cetera, male, Catholic, blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. I don't know what your class is. Do you think you had the semblance of an identity that was created out of all these identities, or you say patterns of behavior and stuff like that? I just want to compare and contrast that to how identity is used right now.
I think it's, you know, identity is such an interesting problem, and the authenticity of identity and the way that that's playing out now in these schools. And I was always had an ambivalent relationship to my social identity. Why all of those categories you just mentioned, white, cis, male, blah, blah. It was, cis wasn't a thing at the time, but just white, male, and blah. That I really didn't feel that I felt that those were inauthentic things, but I was being told that they were authentic, and that who I was actually a denial of that authenticity, and that I had to accept these things. And I just felt, it was all messed up.
That sounds really stressful.
But I really did feel like if you push me, I would have kind of burst out in a kind of autistic rage, in the sense that, like, sorry to any, you know, real autistic people out there,
but I heard artistic kind of, at first, but that's fine.
Oh, autistic. Yeah. I don't know. And that I would want to, I would just say, like, I am a blazing fire of energy, you know, like, you can't, you know, all of these things, these names you put on me, I don't, you know, they mean nothing to me. Like, so I think that's it's something that, you know, it takes a while to come to terms with that.
Yeah. How did you shed that not sense of self? What was the lines of identity making or finding? Or was it a discovery? Mm-hmm. Was it an invention? Was it reinvention? Did you just need to die a few times in the spiritual sense to?
Yeah, I mean, I was in despair many times. And then I talked about in the Jordan Peterson interview, I talked about the most recent incarnation, which was, you know, I was at the end of my rope, really. And then I thought back on when was the last time I experienced any sort of joy or connection with the human race. And it was through tutoring. And then that I kind of took a shot in the dark. I threw a dart on a board, and, you know, I was just like, well, okay, education. I'm also interested in psychology. What's education? Is there an education in psychology thing? And it was a degree in educational psychology. I just Googled it. Oh my God, there's a program at Hunter College. I can go there. I can apply there. I have to do this or I'm going to end it all. It was really just like an either this or that. And once I took me a while to follow through with that. But when I did, I was back in school. I was enjoying being in school. I really liked having friends and that gave me a purpose. And then from that, I went on to teaching and started teaching at Grace Church School, and really enjoyed the richness of experience of teaching children and having, you know, every day was new and different, and the kids were always new and different. And it was just something I could do till I retired, till the end, you know, and get enjoyment out of it. I had had other jobs that I was bored within 3 or 4 years, but this one, you know, up to last year, I was really, and this year too, even though in a pandemic, without this other thing impinging on it, I would be very happy to teach.
Where did that sense of identity reside in that time? And I wonder if having had a ambiguous relationship to your sense of self has given you actually flexibility to adapt as a teacher to a bunch of different selves. Do you think that that?
Yeah, I mean, I was an invention. I had to reinvent myself. I was not very good the first few years. I was not able to multitask and react to children very well. The chaos really pushed my buttons, and I didn't have a good. I mean, I my template for an authority figure was, you know, a misunderstanding of what I thought my father was, and being extremely authoritarian. And I remember trying to insist that the kids do something and, you know, pounding the desk, and they would just laugh at me, right? Because they were whatever, like they were the ones in charge. I had no power. You know, you can't just get someone to do something by saying, you know, do it. No. So I had to invent and learn from my colleagues, like how to construct a functional, persona really that worked. It's still a work in progress. I'm still working on it, but I kind of got better at it. And it was totally trial and error. I was trying to do what worked, essentially. I didn't have, didn't really have a blueprint for it.
How big were your classes at Grace?
Oh, wonderfully small. Like, you know, you don't want them too small, but like 9 to 20.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So very small. And you could really spend a lot of time. If people had questions, you could really, and they were long classes, like 80-minute classes before the pandemic. They got cut down to 60, but longer.
Oh, wow.
Sessions. You can go deep on a concept. You can take more questions. So it really was a wonderful experience teaching.
And you're teaching math?
Math, yeah.
Maths.
Algebra 2 and calculus. Maths. Okay. Maths. As the British say. Yeah.
How do you keep that interesting for 80 minutes?
I always felt class ended early. I always felt like, oh, we didn't get to that thing, you know? Now, I of course, the kids, if you ask the kids, they're probably going to say, how do you keep that interesting? I don't know. You probably should have kept it interesting for me. So I don't know. But I felt like I wasn't too bad.
Were you kind of mathematical for a while? Like, how did you stumble on that? And
in high school,
makes you
I love math.
That? Okay. Why?
Yeah. I mean, I just liked, I liked the beauty of it. I remember really loving calculus. I had a great calculus teacher. I think he's still teaching. He's just a wonderful person who made calculus, you know, come to life for me. And I don't know anything beyond calculus. I don't know any advanced math. I don't know linear algebra. I bought some books on it, but I never had the patience to learn it.
You need an 80-minute course.
Yeah, maybe I need that.
Master.
But yeah. But I you know, I just loved the relationship between, you know, the derivative and the antiderivative and the area under the curve and the slope and the way it all fits together. And it's just like a beautiful, amazing, symmetry there. And it's just, you know, the whole thing is just, it's just remarkable how it all fits together.
And the job is to get that somehow into the kids' heads, right?
Yeah. It's hard because you have to cover a certain amount of content and you can't always hook everyone. But if you can hook some kids and get them interested in it and kind of convey the magic of it, because, you know, I think it is really wonderful and magical. Then you can make an impact, or you could, you know, and there are kids that math isn't their thing, and that's okay. You know, I'm not going to push it on them. Some of them just want, like, I just need to get a B-. I just need to get, you know, okay, fine. I'll help you, you know, let's make some time, you know, let's try to get through these problems. And that's okay.
There's this,
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
There's this a derivative of the diversity, equity, and inclusion package is cultural competency. They've developed a lot in these teaching schools. They've developed a lot of tools for teachers to adapt material to different quote-unquote cultures. I don't know if you can adapt it to a race. Have you, were you, did you find anything useful in that, in translating things or identifying cultures? Like, to what degree is the DEI stuff salvageable and not toxic and useful and actually boosts the education experience for everybody involved? What are some of the things that you think are worth preserving?
Oh, you know, I think, yeah, there's nothing wrong with talking about how math is a global achievement, really. I mean, and there are, the Chinese calculated pi to number of digits based on making like a 1,000 side polygon or something, and talking and really showing that this is not a white male Western achievement. I mean, that's okay, because it's totally real. And I have no problem with working in the history of mathematics in a way that relates to that and is representational to that extent. And that's all good. Where it fits. I mean, it doesn't work if it's not true, or you're trying to shoehorn something in that is not relevant. Mm-hmm. It has to fit with the material. Like, I wouldn't turn a math class into an exploration of ethnic discoveries. It would be like, okay, let's connect this unit that we're doing now to something that was discovered that led to that, mm-hmm. It has to serve the math, not the other way around. We redid our department guidelines in a self-study to include a commitment to do that kind of thing. I didn't do much of it, frankly, and I kind of wanted to. I mean, I kind of would like to. And in general, that CRT-informed DEI and anti-racism didn't really touch my teaching, my math teaching. It wasn't about what was happening to my curriculum or my courses. It was more about watching how the school's programming was affecting the kids in other courses and other classes.
Such as what?
Such as, we would have special seminars, workshops devoted to anti-racism or DEI, and also meetings devoted to it, week-long sessions. I was, hearing about how it was impacting kids in their history and English classes. 1619 project being taught exclusively, without any criticism of it, being something that they, felt they could express. I mean, I don't know, honestly. I'm just going by reports, so I wasn't in those classes, but looking at how it was being pushed and how kids were being induced to identify. And it was really an ontological. I had a problem with what was happening to the kids at an ontological level. Like, what is meant to be in the world? Who are you? I am white, right? And getting the kids to see themselves how other people see them, and prioritizing that identity over their essential, what I feel is important for identity development, which is to be yourself and who you are as a person of conscience in the world. And that being what is the most important thing about being a human being.
Mm-hmm. A person of conscience.
Yeah. And speaking to, being able to transcend all these social categories, which are operative in the world. They do inform bias and racism and how people see you, but you are not how people see you. And I think teaching children to identify with how other people see you is a seduction, like in the etymological sense of the word seduction,
which is
so seduce the the root of that word is duce, like from the Italian, right? Like il duce Mussolini, right? So it means a lead, to lead. Okay. So seduce means to lead away, or to, or to take away, or cause lead to off, to stray, right? So as opposed to education, the root verb of education is
educe.
Educe, right. So educe is to lead out, to draw forth, to bring out the child and to show and to have him express his or her true self, and to joy in that discovery, right? To follow the path of curiosity and interest, and to reveal that revelation of the self. That's how I see education. Mm-hmm. Not an installing or delivery of programming, but a drawing forth of, you know, it's sort of the old dictum, know thyself. Well, how do you know yourself? You have a teacher that helps you to know yourself. You perform the, it's an art. Teaching is an art that draws a child forth, not to lead to some particular sense of themselves, which is prepackaged and labeled for them to adopt, but to like, okay, who are you? You tell me who you are, right? Or you find out for yourself, and you don't even have to tell me who you are. So seduction and you know, eduction are these two things, and one leads to an inauthentic place, and one is an authentic place. Leads to an authentic place, and you know, I was seeing children being led into an inauthentic place with these group being told to identify with group identities based on how other people saw them, and being told that that was actually their authentic identity, and that they were, this was a journey of discovery, that they were being revealed to them that this is who you are, right? And this is who you are in the world, because the world sees you this way, and therefore that's you have to acknowledge it, you have to identify with it as a means to, you know, function and navigate in the world. And I think that's wrong.
It's not just inauthentic, it's impersonal. It's like the way in which an institution would look at people as just these categories to be shuffled around. It's very, I use the word satanic in a very specific form, but it's very materialistic. It's very the lowest level of a human being, and reducing or causing that lowest level to be the highest level, which I guess it is, according to an institution or in court, according to certain ways of viewing the world. Once you prioritize those lowest denominators of the self, you can actually see what happens to society when that starts to happen. And I don't think it is joyous. I haven't seen it be joyous. It's joyous for the victor in that moment, but it never lasts.
But there's a performance of joy, like the joy. Well, okay, just to back up, like, I agree with you. Yeah. I think that what's happening is that these group categories, which seem so, you know, the lowest level of identification and you know, crude and but, you know, banal and all these things, they're infused with a political meaning, which is from, you know, Crenshaw, and like from a person who happens to be black to I am black, right? So that is given, that is, and there's a whole history of revolution and meaning and transcendence of opposition to who you are that's tied up with that. So it's infused with this wonderful, rich history of rebellion and triumph and the great lead, you know. And so that's where I think that that's the meaning that's being used to lead people into it. Because not you get to participate in the grand narrative of history, and who would shy away from that meaning? And so, investing and drawing kids into that project, that historicist project, is very seductive.
Rather Hegelian.
Yeah, well, that's they. You know, these are activist teachers and scholars that want to see history as an unfolding through conflict of, you know, their job is to sort of manifest the apotheosis of our deliverance, right? And that means pushing certain voices to the fore, and those voices are the voices of history. Of course, they have to say the right things. They have to be categorically derived voices. Like, you have to have a black voice that's politically black. You can't have a black voice that has white supremacy, right, exactly, attached to it. So, or, you know, internalized white supremacy. So, you know, to be white in a responsible way means to recognize that your denial of whiteness is inauthentic, and that to be authentic, according to them, is to accept your whiteness. If I denied my whiteness and said, well, actually, I'm Italian, English, and French, well, that would be inauthentic to them. So there's a mirror image of seduction happening with white people, but it's all seduction.
You said earlier that you had that script running in your head, and I know that too because I was at Evergreen and I adopted it. And what caused you to disidentify with it, or what caused you personally to run it, let it run its course, or not allow it to be the front and center? Why is it no longer the front and center? Was it ever the front and center? What made it compatible for you, if it ever was, and what made it incompatible with you, if it isn't?
I started to have real doubts about it. I mean, in starting maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I started to see the influence it was having on children and their development, and watching kids come in 9th grade and becoming more resentful. And, you know, with the very things that were supposed to empower them having the opposite effect and making them suspicious and resentful. And, you know, adopting an identity that was superficially empowering, but actually not seeing it pay off for them. Both, you know, minorities and underserved populations are, you know, under-resourced, and white people, black people. To the extent that kids adopted that ideology, they were hurt by it. And the kids that didn't adopt it were actually had better success outcomes. So, you know, of course, this is not scientific research. This is just qualitatively watching what's going on.
Yeah.
And seeing it happen and thinking there's something not working here. And then I started, you know, watching some intellectuals, Jordan Peterson. Yeah, I know. I went, you know, getting the red pill. But, you know, and fitting the pieces together, reading things that were not on the list.
Is there like a control or somebody that was with you that you knew that wasn't seeing this or ignoring it? How do you not see that? Can you put yourself in the head of somebody who doesn't see that?
I would talk to colleagues about it. And, you know, privately, they would say, yeah, you know, I kind of see that. But I would talk to my mom about it, actually. My mother was someone that I always fought with. I mean, I really made her life tough. I fought with my parents relentlessly through my, you know, 20s and 30s about these issues. And as it started to change me, I was able to reconnect with my mother before she passed. And that was really nice. And she would, we'd have long conversations about it. And
what did she see? Okay.
You know, she had always warned that these ideas were destructive to society and also harmful to the kids. I think she used to tell me that, you know, Derrida ruined your life. Derrida changed you. Where's the Paul I used to know? What happened to you? And there was a lot of truth to that. You know, I'd say postmodernism kind of melted my brain in undergrad in a lot of ways.
Me too, but it was fun while it lasted. What was it about?
It was fun while it lasted, right? It's what a was thrill. It the paradox. The turning, you know, that something could mean the opposite, or that you can undermine a text with just a little dangling thread, and that, you know, what does it mean to even be if you have to describe being in terms of being? The invisible net of signifiers, and underneath it there's an abyss, and, you know, all of these amazing ways of looking at being as a function of language. And if you that's really, I think, the first seduction is that being is a linguistic phenomenon. And if you are a text, if you Benjamin Boyce are an intersection of texts, then you, your essence, your romantic essence of transcending that is, of you know, and is just an imaginary thing. And it's, you are, signifier. You know, the just, right? The, whenever you say that a human being is just something, you've already lost the game. You've already impoverished yourself, in my opinion. Like, that's, you're just a clump of cells. You're just a biological this. You're just some signifiers on a page. You're just your context, whatever it is.
Okay.
You've diminished, and you have taken the bite of the apple at that point, and you're not going to be. You're not going to be yourself, because yourself is always has to be. Now, maybe it all fits together in some way. Maybe the abyss is not an abyss. Maybe the abyss is a suffusion of spirit, and that we, you know, it can blast through the net, and you can find, that's what creativity is. But when I was going through that, I was a frustrated creator, I guess. And I wanted to create through interpretation. And, it was just compensatory behavior for not being able to write or be the genius I thought I was, or whatever that story was.
No umbilical cord, no tether? How did you dangle over the abyss without not just dangling, but
yeah, like it was all things that people who I pushed away, like my family, that were just keeping me tethered without me really admitting or caring, frankly, like not realizing how important family was and friends were, and taking them for granted and you know, taking advantage of them and just not being a, you know, but all of the, but I felt like all these, I think now, like all these people were trying to help me, and I never acknowledged it. I never, because I couldn't, I was just obsessed with other problems. And
did social issues come in to give you purpose out there, or were they temptations to have a grounding? Because that, in one postmodernism, how it becomes a part of what we're seeing now is that once you strip all meaning, then you can rest meaning within oppression. That right. becomes the grounding. Was that something that?
Yeah, was, I mean, I felt like I aligned with causes, and I was LARPing on radical stances, and it's funny, there was like a friend of mine, who, you know, we were working with this environmental activist fellow who recently reached out to me, actually. And I remember him talking about letter writing and protesting. And I was just like, call me when you want to throw a bomb. You know, like I didn't know anything about bombs. Like it was a ridiculous posture, mm-hmm. but you know, the wanting to throw a bomb, the wanting to destroy as an act of definition, mm-hmm. and you know, that was something I was very drawn to.
Did you get to do that creatively somehow? Is there a Hyundai out there in Death Valley that you got to enact your bomb throwing?
No, I was probably too scared or timid to actually even do that, but I wrote a lot of things. I wrote a lot of very violent, disturbing things that...
Short stories, poems, rants?
Yeah, I mean, just rants.
Kind of things?
That kind of stuff, rants, and things that I would read later and be disgusted with. And
Disgusted with aesthetically or ethically? Was there an aesthetic refinement that you were undergoing?
I was really disgusted with myself that I would write this thing and it wouldn't do any good in the world. And who would read this, and why would that help them? Mm-hmm. You know, like, what is the point of all that? What is the point of writing this thing that I felt I needed to get on the page when, you know, it's not going to do any good for anyone? So like, I don't know. I think maybe like the judging self still had some good in him.
There's for me, like, my story aligns with yours in a lot of ways. And I sped up through my postmodern crisis. I took it to the limit and I was done by 24. And I was very lucky to find something that gave me meaning, which was to serve other people in the capacity of a preschool teacher, and learning that. And that is what, for me, made me really realize that the only value in a work of art is what it means to other people. The value is not in what I invest in it. The value is in how I can elicit the value from other people into it. And it still took me years and years and years. I don't think I'm done yet with at least artistically transcending the ego in that way. But it's all based on, the salvation for me was service in a way.
That's great.
Everything contingent on that.
Yeah.
That seems like the mentor solution that you were talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel like that aligns with my experience much later in life around teaching. I think that feeling of having a value for other people and that reward of that relationship and having to invent a persona that was functional and, had that element of service to it is, that changed a lot. And it was in the context of me just trying to do a good job. Just get up in the morning and not regret what I did that day.
Do you think I don't know how to phrase this. I want to like suck a couple proverbs out of you somehow. Like when distilling your experience, and it seems like your story that you're sharing here and then that you shared with Jordan Peterson is a very wayward story for quite a long time. You were able to pull off the wayward kind of the prodigal adventure for a long time. I could only do it for so many years. I didn't have the stamina. But I think that there's a lot of wisdom there once it starts to be processed. And once you come back to society and say, okay, I'm a part of society, you didn't waste that time. You gain skills in being in that area. I just wonder to what extent you're able to empathize with people in that state. And if you have insight into how to reach those people, or if the question is that everybody has to come to it, come back on their own. And there's no way that you could solve that for anybody. There's just people who are going to go on that journey and seduction.
I wish there was. I mean, I think there must be. I think that's a really great question to ask. And when I think about myself, if I met myself today, would I like myself? I wouldn't be able to connect with myself. I don't think. I think it would be very difficult. Like if I was going to give advice to myself in that state, I feel like whatever I offered that person, he would just pour acid on it. And, that doesn't mean that, that's just my experience. If I think about anyone else who's going through the similar thing. I think when I think about the people that tried to help me in that place, and finding the thread out of it, it was the patient. People would try to talk to me, and then later, maybe even months or years later, I'd remember a fragment of something someone said to me, and I would sort of see, the value of it that I wouldn't just sort of crush and throw away in a pile of nihilistic, trash. I would be like, actually, yeah. And it would keep me going.
So you are into composting.
yeah, nihilistic from the flowers of Nihilon. I don't know what. So, to anyone who's in that state, I wish them. I don't know what I can do. I don't know how I could connect there. But that's a really great question to ask.
On the Peterson interview, you said that you're doing writing on and off. Where's your writing at now?
I've been trying to take notes in the morning.
The article on Weiss's Substack was just great. I could just hear a really great voice. I mean, on a really true level, you were operating in from a great space. So I'm just wondering how.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean I had a good editor, and I had written a lot of things leading up to that were pretty loopy. And I really needed people at FAIR, like Barry, to help, you know, really take the hatchet to it. And then I did multiple drafts after that, and I had probably three times as many things I could have talked about and that I did talk about that I cut out of it just to make it, you know, easier, shorter, maybe more impactful. So,
That coming down the pipes, you think?
What's that?
Is there more coming down the pipes?
I'm working on something now that I think, is going to be an interesting piece. It kind of plays with that seduction, adduction thing.
Yeah.
I think like authenticity and how we teach children is part of it. And
that's so authenticity can be very seductive too. It can be, and speaking as somebody who's been running away from my pretension and never able to outpace it,
quest. it's such a mother. Like, have you heard the James Lindsay podcast recently about authenticity?
We were rapping on that, but I didn't listen to the whole thing.
Yeah, no, he's really good. Like he said, there's some little nugget, talk about a little nugget of wisdom. Like authenticity is what you are when you're not trying to be something. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, you know, it's very simple. It's like meditating, like try not to have a thought, but you just have to wait through all of the manifestations of thought until you just kind of stop grabbing at the thing. Stop grabbing at the persona and then waving it around, you know, or like making a self out of some enthusiasm you have for the self and then hanging on to it and presenting it to people as the thing that will impress. I think
that's a natural, that's a, actually, especially in high school, that's what you're supposed to do. That's what, just, that's the part, that's the stage.
Yeah,
ego out.
I know it's necessary. I think you gotta do it. But I don't know. I guess it's sort of like to come. I hate this word. Like, come back to the present. Be in the present moment. You know, like, you know, whatever you are, just whatever, you know, if you try to react to what's happening around you, maybe, I've never been very good at that, but maybe that's the way where you just try to react to things that are coming at you in a way that doesn't necessarily, there's not a preordained correspondence to some. Yeah. Self that you think you should react like a habitual reaction. I don't know.
Yeah, I have to say that I get this weird kind of post-traumatic stress feeling in when I hear certain stories. And what you were talking about being in that online meeting and the training, like I just, any sort of anti-racist training, just imagining putting myself back into that place, like I just get really stressed out. So that was a very stressful part of the Jordan Peterson podcast. Mm. And I was just totally amazed that you were able to keep your cool. I don't know how I would keep my cool. I know that I wouldn't act out. Like I run a channel that does this, that actively breaks down, you know, throws as much postmodernism at this stuff as possible to absolutely make it totally pliable. But in the moment, in that, and I guess it was a Zoom meeting, but still you have like the leader of it and then all this collective believing, like everybody's like supposed to be believing the same way.
I think it was contextual because I was at a, you know, I was supposed to be chaperoning a group of kids at the time. We went to the skating rink. Okay. I logged into this meeting because I thought it was supposed to be, it was a mandatory meeting. So I was multitasking, which is what you do.
So like Thriller is playing on the,
Yeah. Like, so we're wandering around Bryant Park. I have a mask on. It's askew. The sunlight's behind me. I'm looking at this little phone. I can't even see anyone on the phone. It's like a lot of glare, but I'm kind of trying to type in the chat. So I didn't have that experience of like the panopticon where everyone's looking at you. If I was at home with all those people, maybe I wouldn't have said a damn word. But it was because it was everyone was shrunken onto this little device, and I was feeling, you know, just my I was like, oh, you're all just so small in my hand.
Yeah,
you know,
like that like, kids like, in the hall skit, like I'm squishing your head.
There was some of that, I think, that, and I mean, and I can't imagine what I must have, I mean, I must have looked a little frightening to some of the kids, to be honest.
Like towering over
them. Yeah, like this guy lumbering
this
around.
Big white man with the,
the mask askew. He likes, like, what is white? What's a white feeling? You know, I mean, I can see. I mean, I don't think it's harmful. I mean, they said that was harming people. I'm not harming people, but I could see the comic aspects of my what I must have looked like. Yeah. And I think based on what the facilitator told me later, 2 days later, there was a meeting about the meeting for white identifying faculty. There were segregated meetings about to process the segregated meeting. Anyway, she said, you know, she said she came to the meeting to her credit and said, you know, I didn't think that what Paul said was antagonistic or, you know, I felt his questions were in good faith. He was, you know, and she said that she decided to sort of spend more time on it because it was a chance to have an authentic discussion. And, you know, that was my impression. It was good to hear her say that. Now she did have qualms about, you know, race, my questioning of race as a, you know, as a real thing, as a true thing, which I think that they kind of confuse reality and truth there in an interesting way. But my point was that why should I identify with a falsehood? If race is a falsehood, why should I identify with it? And that is the greatest of heresies. You cannot question, you know, race is a social construct, but since racism is real, then we must identify with it. We must.
And denialism of racism is the most racist thing.
Right, exactly. Now, I don't deny racism, but I will deny the truth of race. I will deny the meaning that it has. I mean, I think if you define yourself as how other people see you, if racism is the consequence of a lie and a falsehood, well, then to define yourself by a falsehood is a recapitulation, a reification of that
reification,
falsehood. So I took issue with that. That made its way out of the chat. People heard about it. They felt harmed. I mean, they got upset. And then here I am.
You attack that worldview. You attack the ground, the floor of being. They're sane. Right. I don't know how Heidegger speaks, but
absolutely right. Yeah, that the sane, the Dasein, whatever. That is, you know, from cynical theories. Don't they make the point that like that's the hub around which you can instantiate and give grounding to the postmodern ideas, its identity. And so, you know, that to me, if I was going to give advice to any intellectual movement to marshal your forces and shoot at that exhaust port on the Death Star, I would say hit identity and never stop and just pound away at it. Because if you blow that up, you blow up the whole house of cards. And so, you know, my thinking on this is, you know, neither a person who happens to be black, nor a person who is black, but a person who happens to be seen as black. So like if you are somebody, you are a person, you are an individual, and you don't have to, you can address bias by, you know, that other people feel towards you without having to identify as that thing yourself. I think we need a deracialization. We need a de-identification movement with respect to race in this country. That to me is, you know, I think the way. Now, that's just me, one white guy talking. But
yeah, well, and you're talking to another white guy, so I'm just compounding your fragility here. But as I'm sure if the right people find that, they've already made that comment before they got to this part.
And me being black wouldn't save me anyway, so why do I, you know, who cares?
No,
I might as well speak what I want anyway. So it's not like my whiteness is any worse than my blackness would be if I have whiteness in me, so.
Do you think it's a fallacy to suppose that the identity politic, as it's manifested in critical social justice, identitarian, blah, 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 wokeness, is that filling a vacuum? And if that is filling a vacuum, do we need to return that to a vacuum? Or do we come to terms with what left that vacuum? And what is it replacing?
Yeah, so this is a great question. This is such a fantastic question because, you know, Geistesgeschichte, you know, the whole Hegelian thing, right? Spirit is replaced by spirit in the world. So you can't, if you take that apart, you're just going to leave another nihilistic thing that people are just going to jump on the next paint by numbers morality. People need to have that. So I think this is going to be a spiritual war between the ersatz pseudo morality of wokeness and a reconstituted liberal, you know, like common culture, humanity, individualism, you know, all the good things that we talk about is going to be the locus of a new vertical axis of spirit that's going to recreate a reality, reconstitute a better reality. And it's going to be it's going to be like two columns battling it out, like two lightsabers battling it out. Waving around. And the sparks that fly out from that are going to be the reality we live in.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Very THX of you.
you could hear
what it. Does that look like? what is this reconstituted liberalism look like? Like the orange juice back out of the freezer, mix it up with some soda water. There you go. What does it look like?
Well, ideally it would take the best. It would be a harmonization of the best of both things. Like, there is value in, you know, critical theory. I think there is value in postmodernism. It just needs to have a more productive locus around, you know, the fountain of spirit, which would be, you know, would be coming from a different place, like a sort of classical liberal reconstituted Geist, something that's pouring into the world.
So by Geist, you mean like a collection of ideas or a gestalt or some sort of...
Yeah, like a spirit of the age. Like Like something that is zeitgeist, something that is an unnameable, transcendent upsurge of what you talk about the 60s, right? What created all that great music? What created all that amazing art? Yeah. An eruption, the unseen, you know, the unpredictable, the thing that creates.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel from time to time, the great work would be to lay the ground for that to happen when it does happen, to precipitate the conditions of that occurring. Right.
Yeah.
Which would be
education
and conversation. But it's not education and conversation itself. It's created out of people having conversations and being educated properly, and then they go forth and spark it in some way
It's a community. Barry Weiss talked about this in a podcast with Megyn Kelly. You know, what do we try to reinvigorate the hollowed out institutions? Do we try to take them over? Do we create new stuff? And I'm of the mind that we create new stuff. And you do it with, you don't do it to create some grand thing. You do it so you can live together in a better way. You and your friends, make it happen. You know, just reform communities that are that make your give your life meaning and make things enjoyable, and then those institutions will come to you. And then you can, and then, you know, you'll have value to share with the rest of the world. But you got to start small. You got to start, it's got to be an intimate thing. You know, it can't just be this grand blueprint. You know, that's not going to work. Because you don't know what the blueprint is yet. Like, no one knows what that's going to look like. But like you said, yeah, have conversations, have productive interactions that spark ideas, and then good things will come of it.
You said in the Peterson podcast that you've had offers to go and teach elsewhere. Do you want to continue teaching? Is something else? Do you feel the twitchings of a new work here?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I'd like to keep writing. I'd like to finish another piece. I'd like to tutor. Definitely tutoring is something I can continue those positive experiences and useful experiences with. With kids tutoring, math. I love to do that. So I think there's a way to construct a meaningful life that maybe is different than what I'm used to. More enriching, more rewarding. I'm see where things will lead, where I want to go.
Where would you like to live in America if you moved, if you had a choice to go anywhere? Or the world.
Like, I like where I am. I like okay. where I am. I like my place. I like being in Queens. I like the neighborhood. I like, I have fantasies. You know, everyone has been like, I'd like to go to the woods, or like to go live in the forest or something. But I don't know anything about living in a forest. I don't know how to make a fire. I'm not a.
We have houses out here in the forest, just like.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We even have internet.
Do you just dig a hole to poop in, or do you actually have plumbing?
Combos.
Right. So pump. Civilized. Yeah.
No, yeah, we have.
Do you live in the woods up there in Washington?
Yeah, I'm outside of Olympia, Washington. Yeah, I'm on a peninsula. It's very woodsy. It's very woodsy. It's not uncivilized.
That's beautiful.
What's the other word for? I don't mean uncivilized, but it's not undeveloped. But it's pretty not too developed. So it's just like there's a creek out there, and there's a forest back there, and I take my cats on walks, and
that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, I can dig it. I like the quiet. New York is really intense for me. It's just like that fervor, that energy, all that human being.
I know, it's a lot, and I'm in a kind of a quiet neighborhood, not a very hip neighborhood. It's more like lifestyle. Someone called it.
Oh, okay.
You know? So it's. You know, I got my neighbors in the apartment building, and the little diner on Queens Boulevard with the lunch counter that wraps around, and you can just sit and have a conversation with people.
Oh, wow.
It's, you know, now that we're back to like it's half capacity, you can go and like sit in this place, which is really friendly and nice, and have breakfast, have, you know, a Greek omelet with home fries and rye toast.
Greek omelet that's got those very salty cheese chunks in it.
Is the feta cheese chunks with tomato and
actually that sounds
it's a nice
good.
Not bad.
What's for dinner tonight?
Oh, soup. My wife made some delicious soup.
What kind?
Yeah, it's minestrone? Like it's like chicken. It's got like chicken legs in it. And it's got potatoes, carrots, green beans.
It's like nurturing.
More pepper than usual, too. It's good. I don't have to put the hot sauce in it. She doesn't like when I put the hot sauce in it.
She met you halfway with the peppercorns.
Yeah, exactly. I don't like when she puts mayonnaise on bread either, but you know, we let her do that.
Oh, like mayonnaise peanut butter kind of thing, or just mayonnaise?
No, it's like mayonnaise on lunch and meat. She likes to put mayonnaise on bread and eat it.
Oh, without a meat, a luncheon meat?
Anything. I have a problem. I just have an issue with mayonnaise.
That's kind of an irrational fear of
it oozes me out.
Mayophobic.
I don't like things that are
vinegary, slimy,
creamy. I like vinegar, but not like certain textures that.
Oh, okay.
yeah. give me problems.
I hate cauliflower. Issues. I'll tell you about that.
Oh, yeah. Is it just because it's bland or just the feeling of the...
It's like...
The florets like, in your mouth.
It's like some sort of like a very... It's like some sort of traitorous broccoli.
Ah, yeah.
I don't know.
It is a traitor of... It is like, yeah.
It's like the white man of broccoli, you know?
it has toxic whiteness. It's broccoli with toxic whiteness in it.
It is.
I'm with you. I definitely prefer a nice broccoli. The fibrousness of the broccoli,
It's got some space between the dangly leaf buds or whatever they are. I don't even know what it is. Is it a flower? Or is it like a million flowers all jammed together? I don't know.
You need to have like a botanist. Yeah. In on it, or
you should go over to your compost and see if there's any.
I should ask broccoli. Guys, what is this? Like, what is this stuff here? Like, I've always wondered. Did I come to the right place? Can you help me? No, they would just, I don't know, they'd give me a flyer for some,
yeah,
but
for a march,
yeah.
How can people support you? I guess you're just going to be popping up here and there right now.
I guess you could write to me. I read everything. I have a Gmail account. People say I should get Proton Mail because it's more secure, but it's too late for that. I
mean, is it too late?
I have two emails. I could. I guess I could forward everything.
That's so defeatist. It's too late.
It's too late.
You're set in your ways.
Can't do it. No, but it'd be confusing. Maybe people wouldn't be able to find me anymore if I had switched my email. Yeah. I don't know.
So just give Google all your data. That's fine. Whatever. It's too late now.
Great. don't send me anything. I mean, I'm the only one that sees the inbox, me and Google.
Yeah.
But if you trust Google, you can trust me. No, it's, I don't know. teachingfortruth@gmail.com.
Then what have people been sending you?
I've been getting stories. amazing things. Like people have sent me... people send me their artwork. Someone sent me a novel. Some people send me stories about what they're going through. Most of them are stories about what they're going through. They're students, parents, retired teachers, even like administrators, like the principal of a middle school, like wrote to me telling me how unhappy he was. Things are going on across the country, and,
are we reaching a breaking point? Will that silent majority continue to be silent?
I don't know. I hope so. I don't know enough about history as it happens to be able to make that kind of prediction. All I can say is, work your ass off and try to make it happen. You know, like this is where we are. This is our challenge. This is why we're here. Let's do all we can. And
call to action.
Yeah. Like we have. We should be grateful for this, right? Everyone has their moment and to make a difference, and this is our moment.
That's what they think too.
I know, right? So what are you going to do? Just roll over and
let them have their moment?
Yeah, right. Just make a display of submission and hope that they treat your genitals nicely. I mean, no, I'm not going to do that.
Mm-mm.
No.
Great.
Stand tall. Stand up.
Any plugs of great books or works of art or albums that really inspire you?
I should have thought about that more.
I know. It's kind of a lame on the spot question.
You know what? I got to say, I've been returning to these lectures by David Milch. If you don't know who David Milch is, he is the writer and producer, I believe, of NYPD Blue. I think that was the show.
Really?
You're wrong about this. Deadwood on HBO. Remember the show Deadwood?
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so he gave a series of lectures in 2007 or 2008 during the writer's strike in Los Angeles. There were five lectures that he gave for free in an auditorium. I can't remember where. I was visiting my brother in L.A. He took me to these lectures. They were the most fascinating things I had heard. And I recorded them. They're probably out there on the internet somewhere. I can get them to you. I think that more people need to listen to this because he's a fascinating man. He is suffering I believe, I don't know if he's still with us. He was suffering from Alzheimer's, and there was an article written about him recently. His words and his storytelling about his own life and weaving in Kierkegaard and philosophy and art and all these different things. He's just an amazing storyteller. I listen to them sometimes, and they still affect me. There's great wisdom in them. I would say, I don't know how to get people to them. I don't know where to even send you. But maybe I can send them to you, and you can have a link on the thing.
Okay. I can do that.
Because I think they're of great import, and they could be of great value to us today.
Were they recorded on your Razer phone back in 2007?
No, I actually. Gosh, no, they could have been. I had a Razer. I did. It was very slick looking, but I remember all the skills that I never use anymore.
Oh, really?
Texting, right?
Like, you can still text. I didn't get that good at that.
I learned it. I was pretty good at it. And now, when will I ever do that again?
Someday the QWERTY keyboard will finally be flushed from humanity. And then
that's right.
There'll be this generation of people who learn that. And then
maybe there'll be a whole cult of sort of, you know, archaic people QWERTY that really worship it and are like, well, I only listen to gramophones or vinyl. Like they would just fetishize this thing. They only communicate with this thing. Yeah. 8-track fetishizers of lost mediums, media. Mm.
Yeah. No, that's a thing. That's something that Americans would do in their finer, more lazier and less fraught moments.
Yeah. Remember hipsters, and they weren't political. They just,
they just
found
had, like,
these things.
Mustaches.
Yeah.
Egg white meringue recipes that they trade on the street corners.
Yeah. Isn't that, those are happier times.
I don't
even
know.
That's when all the bad stuff started. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I got sick of it. That's why I left Portland. It got too Portland. And now it's like, now it really went to Portland. That was like 10 years ago. I'm like, I gotta get here. It's like, I went here to get away from these people and to retire in my 20s. That's what I wanted to do. And then everybody else started doing that. And I'm like, I can't compete in this market. I'm going to go.
Yeah. You got to stay ahead of the wave. Well, you're doing great stuff.
Kids. Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's always
a pleasure when somebody pops up on my radar. I'm like, would you like to come on my show? They're like, oh, I know you. I'm like, yes.
Yep. Yep. Long time listener, long time fan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, hopefully you have a place for your new time fans to congregate, and not just your inbox. Maybe you could create a Discord or some sort of channel of your own.
It's a thought. Yeah, it's a thought.
You're really chill, I have to say. Of all the conversants, you're on the more conversing side of my conversations. You're very calm.
That's a good place to be. I'm very honored to be there.
You're very calm.
That's an honor. That's an honor to be in that place. And likewise, you're very chill. You're on the much chiller end of the. I mean, nothing against anyone I've talked to, but you're in the sweet spot too. So.
Can I end the recording? I want to ask you.
Yeah, sure.
Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.